Chapter 13. Feet pounded on deck. A lieutenant appeared at the door and Falconer engaged him in urgent conversation. Farley, he called, you might as well get back to your loft. The architect left without a word. Falconer said, please wait here, Bell. I won't be a minute. He stepped outside with his lieutenant. Bell had seen the Roiterdahl painting of the Great White Fleet on the cover of Collier's magazine last January. The fleet lay anchored in the harbor of Rio de Janeiro. A native boat was rowing toward the bright white hull of the anchored flagship Connecticut, waving an advertisement that read, American Drinks, Square Deal at J.S. Gouverneur. Smoke and shadow in a dark corner of the sunny harbor scene obscured the sleek gray hull of a German cruiser. The deck moved under Bell's feet. The yacht began backing out of her slip into the East River. When she engaged her propellers ahead and wheeled downstream, Bell felt no vibrations, nor even the faintest throbbing of the engines. Captain Falconer stepped back into the cabin, and Bell gave his host a curious glance. I've never been on such a smooth-running steam yacht. Falconer grinned proudly. Turbines, he said. Three of them, linked to 9 screw propellers. He pointed at another painting, one which Bell had not seen from the porthole. It depicted Turbinia, the famous experimental turbine-powered vessel Alistair MacDonald's mentor had raced through an international gathering of naval fleets at Spitzhead, England, to dramatize turbine speed. Charles Parsons left nothing to chance. In the event that something went wrong with Turbinia, he built 2 turbine racers. This one's named Dyname. Do you remember your Greek? The result of forces acting together. Very good. Dyname is actually Turbinia's big sister, a trifle beamier, modeled after the torpedo boats of the 90s. I had her refitted as a yacht and converted her boilers to oil, which opened up a lot of space in the former coal bunkers. Poor Alistair used her as a test craft and modified the turbines. Thanks to him, even though she's beamier than Turbinia, she burns less fuel and goes faster. How fast? Falconer laid an affectionate hand on Dyname's varnished mahogany and grinned. You would not believe me if I told you. The tall detective grinned back. I wouldn't mind a trick at the helm. Wait till we're out of congested waters. I don't dare open her up in the harbor. The yacht steamed down the East River into the upper bay and increased her speed dramatically. Quite a clip, said Bell. Falconer chuckled. We rein her in until we reach the open sea. The lights of Manhattan Island faded astern. A steward appeared bearing covered dishes and spread them on the table. Captain Falconer bid Bell sit across from him. Bell stood where he was and asked, what is Hull 44? Please join me for supper, and while we head to sea, I will tell you the secret of why Hull 44. Falconer began by echoing Alistair MacDonald's lament. It's 10 years since Germany started building a modern navy. The same year we captured the Philippine Islands and annexed the Kingdom of Hawaii. Today the Germans have dreadnought battleships. The British have dreadnought battleships, and the Japanese are building and buying dreadnought battleships. So when the U.S. Navy embarks on distant service to defend America's new territories in the Pacific, we will be outclassed and outgunned by the Germans and the British and the Empire of Japan. Brimming with such zeal that he left his beefsteak untouched, Captain Falconer regaled Isaac Bell with the dream behind Hull 44. The dreadnought race teaches that change is always preceded by a universal conviction that there is nothing new under the sun. Before the British launched HMS Dreadnought, 2 facts about battleships were engraved in stone. They took many years to build, and they had to be armed with a great variety of guns to defend themselves. HMS Dreadnought is an all-big-guns ship, and they built her in a single year, which changed the world forever. Hull 44 is my response, America's response. I recruited the best brains in the fighting ship business. I told them to do their damnedest. Men like Artie Langner, the Gunner, and Alistair, whom you met. And saw die, Bell interrupted grimly. Artists, every one of them. But like all artists, they're misfits. Bohemians, eccentrics, if not plain loony. Not the sort that get along in the regular Navy. But thanks to my misfit geniuses hatching new ideas and refining old ones, Hull 44 will be a dreadnought battleship like none that sail the seas. An American engineering marvel that will overwhelm the British dreadnought and the German Nassau and Posen, and the worst Japan can throw at her. Why are you shaking your head, Mr. Bell? That's too big a deal to keep secret. You're obviously a wealthy man, but no individual is rich enough to launch his own dreadnought. Where do you get your funds for Hull 44? Surely someone high up must know. Captain Falconer answered obliquely. 11 years ago, I had the privilege of advising an assistant secretary of the Navy. Bully! Bell smiled his understanding. That explained Lowell Falconer's independence. Today, that assistant secretary of the Navy was none other than the nation's fiercest champion of a strong Navy, President Theodore Roosevelt. The president believes that our Navy should be footloose. Let the Army defend ports and harbors. We'll even build them the guns. But the Navy must fight at sea. From what I've seen of the Navy, said Bell, first you will have to fight the Navy. And to win that fight, you would have to be clever as Machiavelli. Oh, but I am, Falconer smiled. Though I prefer the word devious to clever. Are you still a serving officer? I am. Officially, Special Inspector of Target Practice. A wonderfully vague title, Bell remarked. I know how to outfox bureaucrats, Falconer shot back. I know my way around Congress, he continued with a cynical smile and raised his maimed hand for Bell to see. What politician dares deny a war hero? Then he explained in detail how he had planted a cadre of like-minded younger officers in the key bureaus of ordnance and construction. Together they were angling to overhaul the entire dreadnought building system. Are we as far behind as Alistair MacDonald claimed? Yes. We launch Michigan next month, but she's no prize. Delaware, North Dakota, Utah, Florida, Arkansas, and Wyoming, first-class dreadnoughts are stuck on the drawing boards. But that's not entirely a bad thing. Advancements in naval warfare pile up so quickly that the later we launch our battleships, the more modern they will be. We've already learned the shortcomings of the Great White Fleet long before it reaches San Francisco. First thing we'll fix when they sail home is to paint them gray so enemy gunners can't spot them so easily. Paint will be the easy part. Before we can turn our new knowledge into fighting ships, we have to convince the Navy Board of Construction and Congress. The Navy Board of Construction hates change, and Congress hates expense. Falconer nodded at the Reuterdahl. My friend Henry's got his tail in a crack. The Navy invited him along to paint pictures of the Great White Fleet. They did not expect him to also fire off articles to McClure's magazine informing the world of its shortcomings. Henry will be lucky to find his way home on a tramp steamer. But Henry's right. And I'm right. It's okay to learn by experience. Okay to learn by failure, even. But it's not okay not to improve. That is why I build in secret. You've told me why. You've not told me what. Don't be impatient, Mr. Bell. A man was murdered, Isaac Bell replied grimly. I am not patient when men are murdered. You just said men. Captain Falconer stopped bantering and demanded, Are you suggesting that Langner was murdered too? I rate his murder increasingly likely. What about Grover Lakewood? Van Dorn operatives in Westchester are looking into his death. And in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, we are investigating the accident that killed Chad Gordon. Now, are you going to tell me about Hull 44? Let's get topside. You'll see what I mean. Dynamae had continued to increase her speed. There was still no trembling from the engines, despite a powerful drone of rushing sea and wind. The steward and a sailor appeared with sea boots and oilskins. You'll want these on, sir. She's no yacht once she gets moving. More like a torpedo boat. Torpedo boat hell, muttered the sailor. She's a submarine. Falconer handed Bell a pair of goggles with smoked glass so dark it seemed opaque, and looped another pair over his own head. What's this for? You'll be glad you have them when you need them, the captain answered enigmatically. All set. Let's get up to the bridge while we can. The seaman and steward wrestled the door open, and they stepped on deck. The slipstream hit like a punch in the face. Bell pushed forward on the narrow side deck less than 5 feet above the rushing water. She must be doing 30 knots. Still loafing along, Falconer yelled over the roar. We'll get moving once we pass Sandy Hook. Bell glanced back. Fire was flickering from the smoke funnel, and the wake was so frothed that it glowed in the dark. They climbed onto the open bridge, where thick slabs of glass screened the helmsman who was clinging to a small spoked wheel. Captain Falconer shouldered him aside. Ahead in the dark, an intermittent white light blinked every 15 seconds. Sandy Hook lightship, said Captain Falconer. Last year we'll see it. They're moving the light to mark the new Ambrose Channel. Dyname bore down on the 15-second blinker. In its back glow, Bell glimpsed the white-lettered Sandy Hook and number 51 on the side of the black vessel as it fell rapidly behind them. Hang on, said Captain Falconer. He laid the hand with the missing fingers on a tall lever. Bowden cable connection direct to the turbines. Same as flexible cable brakes for bicycles. I can increase steam from the helm without ringing the engine room. Like the throttle on your auto. Alistair's idea? Asked Bell. No, this is mine. You're about to feel Alistair's.